This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community devoted to these very themes. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today we're going to be speaking to a scholar who has devoted his entire career to the study of death and the ways in which technology interacts with the dead body.
I've never not known death. One of my earliest memories of childhood is a woman in an open casket at the funeral home and being there with my parents. I must have been 3 or 4. Yeah. And I remember touching her hand and her hand being cold. Although, as my dad would always say, it's not cold, it's room temperature. And and then just learning what death was based on that. Yeah.
Have you also had a drive at some point in your life, perhaps, to understand the idea of death through study? If so, we would love to hear about it.
This is my bereavement story that shifted the way that I think about living and dying. I once had a sister who lived to be 24 years old. She passed out of nowhere. And her boyfriend tried to resuscitate her and ended up getting in the ambulance there to try and restart her. And they brought her to the ER. And during that time, he called me. So I lived next to her and I went directly over to her house and watched the ambulance take her away and then went down to the ER, waited. Like, being an American, I just thought that all stories ended happily, and I just knew she was going to be fine because there wasn't a reason. They brought me in to watch as they took her off of life support, and I thought when they were taking the machines off that she was actually she was coming back to life, and then the doctors and medical team were telling me they were standing there waiting in case something happened, but she did not come back. And then I was able to spend the next 3 hours there with her body waiting for the coroner. And I'm actually so grateful for that time because it was the time that I had with her body to process it. And it gave me so much closure. But it was the strangest thing when the coroner came back. I just remember these feelings of this is I don't know this guy and I don't even want him. I don't want him zipping up the zipper. I just remember trying to pushing him away so I could help put her in the bag. And then I pushed him off so that I could put the zipper up because she was my baby sister. And I was in charge of her. I couldn't understand why this other person was taking over. She had to go with them. I had no say. I wanted to have her body sent from Portland back down to the hometown that we're from, learning that in the state of Oregon, you can only transport a body for up to 6 hours without refrigeration. And thankfully we didn't have to cross state boundaries or anything, but these are just things that I never even thought about until having to deal with it.
Whew. Wow, Erin, so powerful and touching. I'm so sorry you had to go through all that, and I really appreciate you sharing it with us.
If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. All right, so I'm going to start with a little introduction, John, so don't be too bashful about it. Okay, so today I'm delighted to welcome my friend and colleague, John Troyer. John is the director at large at the Center for Death and Society at the University of Bath, where he also teaches. He is the author of Technologies of the Human Corpse, an MIT Press book that is at once a scholarly exploration of technologies of the corpse and a meditation on grief and loss as experienced through the untimely death of his sister. John has also been a part of the Morbid Anatomy community since the very beginning, Over the years, he has served as scholar in residence, where he also cleaned windows in preparation for an opening party, contributed essays to our books, The Morbid Anatomy Anthology and Death, a Graveside Companion, led reading groups, and given many memorable talks, at one of which he met his girlfriend for a while. He is also one of the smartest and most interesting people I know, and we are so lucky to have him as a part of the community. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joanna. Yes. you got all the history there. Yeah, indeed. Yes, it's great. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Oh, it's so wonderful to have you. And John, I know that of all the people I'm talking to, your introduction to death is probably the most interesting, unusual, and unique. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your formative experiences around death.
Sure. Thank you, Joanna. Yes. So why? That's my introduction to death. So unique compared to most people. Well, it's not. It is and it isn't. I think so. It is, yes, in the following ways. I was introduced to death in large part because my father, Ron Troyer, was a funeral director for 35 years. So I grew up in the American funeral industry. You know, death was just sort of everywhere apparent. My dad had gone to school for mortuary science at the University of Minnesota and had gotten his degree. And he and my mom had met while they were both undergraduates at the University of Minnesota. So when I was born, I was born into, you know, the funeral home family. Now, we never lived in the funeral home. So this is one important distinction. We never actually lived at a funeral home. We always lived at a house and my dad would go to work. So that's one thing. But I just grew up around death and dying so much so it would only be years later. And I've talked about this in lots of different places. It would only be years later. I would figure out that how I grew up, my sister and I both, how we grew up, was just different than how other people grew up, that death was by and large just largely normalized. There was just no question about that. And it's had an impact. Like, I'm not going to lie about it. It definitely has. And is,
how could it not?
Exactly. But in a way that wasn't obvious, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, this is what my dad does. That's his job. Like, he didn't really think about it. But the professional work I do, the academic work, it certainly had an impact. But yeah, that was how I got introduced to death and dying.
And was there ever a moment when you thought you might go into the family industry? Or did you always kind of know you wanted to direct this outward in another direction?
I never thought about becoming a funeral director ever. I never really entertained that idea. My dad never talked to me about it. If I'd wanted to, he would have been fine with it, but I didn't. I wanted to do other things. I studied other topics, and that was the way it was. It was only rather circuitously that I ended up talking or figuring out that I was interested in writing about death and dying in graduate school during my PhD. But that was not what I set out to do. It was just really by chance, as many people find with their PhDs. Like you think you're going to write about one thing, and then it becomes something totally different. And that's what happened to me.
What did you write about in your PhD, and what was the program?
So I did my PhD at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature, and it's the program in Comparative Studies in Discourse and Society. So it's an interdisciplinary studies program. Covers any number of topics. It's similar, sort of a sibling program to the History of Consciousness program at Santa Cruz, which is much better well known. And Joanna, you and I have talked about HISCON over the years.
Oh, yes, we have.
You can kind of really work on whatever you want to, but you have to, you know, make the case for what it is. So, but also too, it's, you know, any project is going to be heavily influenced through sort of literature and philosophy and politics and aesthetics. And I mean, you name it, religion, could be any number of things. And so I was there in the program, and it was actually in the second year of my program. So I already made it through 1 year talking about all different kinds of projects I wanted to do, and none of them were really panning out. And then I just kind of hit upon this idea of like, well, what is the relationship between technology as a concept, which I was interested in, and then death and dying. And that was when I really sort of stumbled upon, you know, embalming during the Civil War. But also to photography and images of embalmers doing their work. And that was sort of how it all started.
Yeah, which makes me think of the title for the first talk you ever gave for us, I believe, which was Bodies by Us Don't Turn Black.
Bodies by Us Never Turn Black. Yep,
that's never right. Never Turn Black, that's yep, it.
That's right, because that was a slogan. It was a pitch about why an embalming fluid of the time, late 19th or like 20th century, why it was so good, because the bodies would not, you know, turn black. It wouldn't have the discoloration of decomposition. Yep, absolutely.
And John, how did you end up discovering the Center for Death and Society at the University of Bath? And can you tell us a little bit about what they do?
Sure. The Center for Death and Society has been around for 20 years. 2025 is our 20th anniversary. And it was founded, if you're doing the math, in 2005. And I was, which is part of how I discovered it. So what happened was it was opened by, its founding director is Glennis Howeth, who's now retired professor, sociology professor. And Glennis had started it with some other colleagues as an important addition to death studies writ large as an academic field, in part because there wasn't really any interdisciplinary academic study center that looked at death and dying. And and ironically enough, there still isn't today, really, outside of the Center for Death and Society. I mean, we really do stand out as sort of like one of the only interdisciplinary study centers of its kind. There are different groups, different places, like networks of people within like medical schools or religious studies programs, but we're the only sort of like freestanding center that does that. And for no good reason. It's not like these places couldn't open other places. So people haven't done it. So the center was opened, and that was actually at the same time I was into the final throes of my PhD. And this becomes important because I needed a job after I graduated. And every other year, there's a big international death studies conference, which is a semi-annual meeting on the social context of death, dying, and disposal, sometimes just referred to as the Death, Dying, and Disposal Conference, or the DDD Conference. And that year, the University of Bath was hosting it to launch the Center for Death and Society, or as part of the hosting the conference, the Center for Death and Society would launch. And I didn't know anything about this conference existed. I didn't know anything about the people who worked in what was called death studies in the UK or Europe. I didn't know anything about any of it, really. I was completely ignorant in a very embarrassing way. But by chance, my dissertation supervisor, John Archer, God bless him for dealing with me, he sent me an email about this conference on death, dying, and disposal, and said, "Do you know anything about this? Maybe you should go to this." And I was like, "No, I don't. What is this? Like, this is, what is happening? I had no idea." So I submitted, it's a funny story. It's a funny story about what happens in graduate school. I submitted a proposal, actually talking about organ transplantation of all things. It got accepted. But then I kind of started to chicken out. I was like, "Oh, I don't think I should go. I don't know if I can do this." So I tried to get out of it by emailing Glennis Howeth, the founding director of the Center for Death and Society, explaining to her, I'm like, "Oh, I'm really sorry. I don't think I can get the money. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do it to make the flight." And thinking, okay, I got myself out of that one. She emailed me back and said, "I totally understand. Don't worry. If you can get here, we'll cover all your expenses for the conference. You just have to pay for the flight." And I was like, no, I have to go. Do you know what I mean? And that's totally what happened. It's exactly what happened. I'm sure I still have the email somewhere if I went to find them. So I'm like, okay, great. Thank you. God, no, I got to do this. So I got the money from my department. They took care of it. And then, as was promised, all of my expenses for the conference, everything was paid for, the whole thing. Get to the conference, and I just, as many people have this experience at the DDD conference, if anyone's listening who's been to one of those conferences who had not been before, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's actually the same thing with it's the very same thing with morbid anatomy in a lot of ways too, which is you get there and you're like, "Oh my God, I felt like I've discovered my people. Like, I had no idea that there are all these people like me. Like, who are all these people? I had no idea." in much more of it like an academic setting. And so I get there, I go to the conference, and the center launches there, and I'm like, I gotta work at this place. Like, this is, I need to work here. This is where I need to work. Because just a couple of years before all of this happens, I had been in a meeting with my PhD supervisor, and we'd had a meeting about what I was going to do with my PhD once I was done, and which is one of the sort of perfunctory meetings you get to when you head into the final stages. So this is, I guess, a couple of years before the Center for Depth and Study even exists, and I didn't even know it was a thing. And my PhD supervisor says, like, "So John, you're doing this PhD on the dead body and technology." I'm like, "Yes, I am." And he goes, "Okay, so where are you going to get a job with this?" And which was a fair question. I was a bit caught off guard, but it was a fair question. And I remember saying to him, I'm going to get a job. I think it's something effective, like where they study death, or I can work on death and dying. And there was sort of like this, just sort of the silence in the room. My supervisor says to me, he's like, "Where do they do that?" And what I said was, I'll never forget this. I was like, "I don't know, but I'm going to find it." And that worked. And again, that was 2 years before the Center for Death and Study existed anyway. So anyway, point is, I go to the conference. I then, thanking the then founding director of the Center for Death and Study, Glennis Howe, really, I owe so much to. And as like the last night of the conference, I see Glennis and I'm like, "Glennis, I want to thank you so much for all your support and everything you've done." And she's like, "Oh, of course." I'm like, "And also too, like, you know, I'm going to finish my PhD. I'm going to need a job, and I think you should hire me." And she was like, "I think that's a very good idea. I think we should." And I was like, I can't believe that just worked. Like, that never works. Like, and I'd never done anything like that before or since, quite frankly.
Well, because you were the perfect fit. It wasn't just you trying to be a huckster, you know?
No, like, I know. I was like, "Oh my God." And that's how I ended up there. And I've had a whole career. And I've had a whole career where I've done things I never would have done. I know that. But for the fact that I moved, you know, to Bath, which is, you know, not exactly anyone's. I mean, it's a place people go to for, like, on a tourist stop. It's not necessarily a place people think about as being this hub. It's a good university, but also, too, like, a hub of, like, research around death and dying. But we really are. And we've built up a whole international network. And I have great colleagues all around the world. And we've, you know, I've been very proud of the work we've been able to do there and groups and people we've been able to work with.
That's so great.
But the center itself does really important interdisciplinary work around all things on death, dying, and the dead body, grief, bereavement, you name it. We've done many, many, many different kinds of projects over the years around, you know, thinking around like what is technology for cemeteries. I've worked on that. I have colleagues who've worked around funeral affordability, economics of death and dying. Some of our colleagues are working on projects, you know, in many different countries, including Africa, different African nations, conflict zones, war zones, any number of topics around digital death and dying, which is a perennial topic. The death tech revolution in digital tech is somehow always like 5 years away, and it's been like that for the last 20 years. So, I say that in light, but I mean, it's, you know, there's all these things we're always looking at, you know, rethinking the canonical texts of death and dying. And I teach a class. One of the classes I teach every year is sociology of death. And I should make it clear to colleagues, everyone now on the podcast, you're a colleague. I should make it clear to people that I'm not a sociologist, although that is my post. And I'm not saying that in any kind of defensive way. I'm saying that out of deep respect for everyone who is a sociologist. And it's, you know, it's just such a great, it's such a pleasure to teach, like just to talk to our final year students who are usually in their early 20s. You know, getting them to think about death and dying and all these topics. And, you know, generally all of them are like, "Oh, God, I really like thinking about this."
Quick question on the back of what you said. How popular are these classes with undergraduates, with young people? Are they into this topic?
Very popular. Yeah, the sociology of death class has always been, regardless of who teaches it. I've taught it for a number of years now, but my predecessors who've taught it, it's always a class that's popular to sign up to. And it's because it's got the word death in it. I mean, that's the thing. Like I always ask the students, I'm like, how many of you took this class because it's got the word sociology in it? And they're like, I'm like, how many of you took a class because it's got the word death in it? And they're like, yeah, like that's why I want to take it. You know what I mean?
So what is that draw, John? I know we've discussed this at length in many, many situations, but you know, in this context of ecurity, why does the word death draw young people, not just young people, because here we are, right? Why does it fascinate so many people?
Why is anyone listening to this podcast?
Exactly.
Because we really want to talk about it. Each week is a different topic, the way I teach it right now. Second semester is going to be different speakers coming in and presenting their work on death and
Oh, that's
dying.
so
But
cool.
the last week, actually, what we covered was Ernest Becker's The Denial of Death, and then also Lynn Loughlin's The Craft of Dying, two of my favorite texts to talk about.
Maybe some of our listeners might not be familiar with Ernst Becker's work enough to kind of know what what you're talking about here. So I wonder if you just want to kind of sum up, you know, what his place in the history of death is, like his, you know, his lauded place and what his argument is, and
Actually, I'll do Becker and Laughlin, I think,
a
because I forgot to.
perfect,
Yeah,
perfect.
you're both like, right. So, in full disclosure, Joanne and I have run book clubs on both Ernest Becker and Lynn Loughlin.
We've gone deep into these books and heard
Yeah, in
lots of
2023,
reflection and
it was,
discussion.
and then also Lynn Loughlin is a, we did her book, The Craft of Dying. Anyone who's been to a book club, particularly a book club around death and dying, the Becker Denial of Death book club, and I'll say more about the text in just a second in case you're like, what's this book about? What was most fascinating about that book club was one, like, I don't know, like over 100 people signed up for it. Like it
Did they? I
was,
don't even remember
oh
that. Was
God, it
it
was
that many
huge. It was,
people?
I'm like, this is like a lecture. It's not a book club. But they signed up for it. And I would say the majority of the individuals who signed up for it were men. Like I've never seen that many men in one book club, which is not to say it's not a masculine activity. I want to be clear about that. But like actively engaged and like really going for it was
Passionately engaged, I
passionately
would
about the
say,
Becker
having
argument.
arguments. There were almost fights in that class,
I know.
which is.
Well, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. Becker's book seems to carry a real appeal for male readers or many cases, in case
Yes.
any women or anyone who wants to
Oh,
find
I
themselves
loved it as
listens
a
to it.
woman reading it too. So I
Yeah, I
don't
know,
want
I
to
know.
all.
And
No,
they're like,
but it's not that there were women in the class too, but I think what maybe listeners might not be aware of, that we'll get to in a further discussion, is that in the deathosphere, as we fondly call it, it is
yeah,
mostly women, right?
that's right.
So
Yeah,
there,
absolutely.
it was a real, and in Morbid Anatomy's community is, like, I'd say, to be generous, 70% women. You know, my classes are almost 95% women. So that's the backdrop against which this is unfolding that I think is really important as you're having this conversation.
Yeah, no, it comes out in 1973. For those who don't know, it wins the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction.
It makes an appearance in Annie Hall. So it's a kind of a cultural phenomenon as well, right?
Over the years becomes a real cultural like landmark. Although it doesn't start out that way, it kind of becomes that. And it's very much reflective of early 1970s. I actually think what Becker presents in the book is a critique of the Vietnam War, because he's very much interested in he's running it in the middle of Vietnam. So there was a lot of death and dying already in the sort of just everywhere apparent, like everything from like, nightly, scrolls of like dead in Vietnam, US dead, to just sort of a, general kind of, as Jimmy Carter would eventually come to call it, like malaise, had settled in that way. So in the book, Becker lays out that, in the denial of death, that becomes the cornerstone or the most important part of human culture and development. He's making a very Freudian argument. Literally, I mean, there are great sections in the book where he talks about like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung him interacting, and like all he wants to do is praise Freud and what Freud did, but he wants to do something that's important, which is he wants to say Freud is the greatest thinker of our time, of all modernity, but he made one crucial fundamental error, which is it is not the repression of sexuality that is the cornerstone of human identity, it is the repression of death. So he says, so all I'm trying to do here is just switch out sex and replace it with death, which is, I want to suggest is not a minor like tweaking of Freud. I mean, I've never read. I mean, Becker tries to sort of like make it sound like I'm just making this small change to Freud. I don't think it's a small change. I really don't. I mean, Freud talks about death quite a bit. There's no question about that. Becker's trying to do something different with Freud to a certain extent. Anyway, I would suggest so much of the discourse around that everyone's in denial about death, or that there is a death taboo, you know, sort of remains forbidden. He really becomes one of the popularizers of that. But there were many writers in the 70s, one of which I've already mentioned, Lynn Laughlin, who's writing in the later part of the 70s, 78. She's a sociologist, and she writes a really important book called The Craft of Dying, in which she really wants to challenge the death taboo argument in her book by saying, well, it's kind of hard to say that it is a taboo based on the fact that now across the 70s, better part of a decade, we've had like nonstop publications, talking groups, like, you know, encounter groups, like consciousness raising, social movements all around death and dying. What's important to bear in mind is that the taboo becomes useful. Like it's a useful foil for all of the death groups that want to have an enemy to work against.
And there's something else at its base that came out in our discussions that I feel like there's a this kind of assumption of a certain desire for immortality, which we definitely see playing out now, right? And what we were discussing after class is like, do you want to live forever? You know, mostly who are the people that want to live forever? Not a lot of women, in my experience, answer that question the affirmative. And I began when we were doing that reading group to think, well, I think Ernst Becker is a really great summing up of white cis men of a certain generation's attitudes towards death. And in that way, it's amazing. And that is the dominant class that has shaped our culture. And so it's got a lot, you know, a lot of importance for that reason. But it doesn't speak to everyone. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you think it affects men and women differently, and why you think most people in the modern deathosphere that we experience are in fact women, or not cis white men, let's say that.
I've forgotten about the Immortality Project a lot. You're actually right, because I remember talking about this actually with everyone in the book group, but also too with you about how, you know, Becker goes, he makes a whole point of saying like this book is not meant as a is like an immortality project. Like, he's
Ha!
deeply skeptical of
Yes!
immortality. He says this, he's like, I'm deeply skeptical of immortality projects, but of course it's an immortality
It's
project.
absolutely, he won the Pulitzer for it, and
Yeah,
we're
no,
still
I'm just.
talking about it. And wait, can you actually just quickly explain what an immortality project is for those who might not know?
So, you know, like something that goes down that, like, you know, makes you immortal and sort of like
In a
the sense of
symbolic
like the
way.
cultural zeitgeist in a symbolic way, that kind of thing. Becker is dying while he's writing this book.
And that's
So,
so important.
yeah, he's 43, I think. I mean, he's in his 40s when he's dying.
And he's had a tough life. Like
Yeah.
he was in one of the like army battalions that
Yeah.
freed the concentration camps. He
I certainly
saw
remember.
atrocity firsthand. He was a Jewish
He
Canadian,
was,
right?
right.
So
He was
this guy
also,
didn't have an easy
no,
time of
he
it
had seen a
either.
lot, and he is in the end stages of cancer. I want to say it was published posthumously, or he
I think you're
died
right.
about the same time. But one of the last interviews he does about the book is with Psychology Today, and there are tapes from that interview, and that is literally on his deathbed. He is dying as this book comes out. And I think that can't help but shape a kind of idea around, you know, what do I want to say about death and dying and what happens? He'll try and say it doesn't. I'll take him at his word, but I tend to think like he, you know, I think he kind of it was or it did.
I also think, as we're talking about authors' decisions not to bring the personal aspects of death into their book, I'm thinking of your book that you did for MIT, which I think, from what I know about it, you intended as a straight up academic text, but then things began to happen while you were writing that book that changed. And I wonder if you could just speak a little bit about that and why you chose to bring in your personal life in a way that Ernst Becker did not.
So as for my own book, it was going to be more of a standard, I guess, what I would say, issue academic text. And while I was working on it, my sister Julie, younger sister Julie, she was diagnosed with brain cancer in late July of 2017. And she lived for about a year. She lived, it was an aggressive glioblastoma. And so she made it a year, which is sometimes better than, you know, some people are able to do in Italy, where she lived with her husband, who's Italian, and their two young kids. And she then died in July, so July 29th of 2018. And you know, that experience was, well, it's just, it was, there's no way around it. It was just like, it was, you know, it was just terrible in all the ways you can imagine. And I was talking with my editor about it, and I at MIT Press, and I had said, would it be possible to write something about my sister for this book? This was about a year after she died, so I'm several years behind schedule on this book. And MIT Press, to its credit in general, was like, yeah, that sounds great, please do. In part because the press had always been encouraging me to write more about my own autobiographical experience of death and dying, partly because of the way of my dad, and I'd always resisted it. I'm like, God, this is not a memoir. I'm not a memoirist. Like, I don't, like, this is not my thing. You know what I mean? Like, I'm an academic, by God. Anyway, which was dumb. I was being very dumb, and so I did that. And you know, and I've always said this. I've always said this. So what I did is I wrote, there's a preface to the book that's about the experience of my sister's death. That was important to write. I mean, I remember I sat down and started typing, and it just flew right out. I was like, you know, like, just came flying out, not and almost kind of fully formed. Like, that was a weird part. I was like, which made sense to me because I wanted to write about it. So I wrote a preface, and then I said, and also too, I've been writing like poetry prose pieces, which is what I've been doing for the better part of my adult life anyway, about life experiences as I go along. It's just something I did. I have a whole other past life as a performance poet and poetry slams and things like that, which is not important, but related to this. And I said, would it be okay to include those? And they said, yes. Now, so depending on how you feel about this kind of thing, and I honestly, I just, if you were to read the book and you, the preface, I think is, it stands alone. Why did I include the poetry prose pieces? And I did it. It's a conversation between me and my sister who would never read the book. And that's why they're there. I honestly don't care. I'm saying all this because I know that some readers have not been fond of those. And actually,
Really?
well, no, it's fine. It's okay. I remember at one point someone described it as like, the book is great except for all the insufferable poetry. And it made me laugh because I thought, oh, my sister would love that. She'd think that was hilarious. You know, she'd be like, because she would kind of poetry slam sometimes. She'd be like, oh my God, like, you know, like, what do you do anyway? So that went in there. And then also too, there's an epilogue. So my dad, while we're going to press, has a cardiac arrest and like dies, but is resuscitated and in the ICU, and we don't know what's going on. And I'm like, so my dad might be dying any moment, and I'm like, can I include? And so I include that. He actually ends up recovering, so it's clear. Like, he and my mom, like, he recovers. We then get into COVID, so this is before everything happens with COVID. That's all in there. And but the thing about adding my sister to the book was, and I've said this in lots of places, is that it you know, it made the book a better book. It just makes it a better book, I think. I
I
think it
agree
makes it
with
a
that.
more complicated text. I think it makes it a richer, more interesting text. It was more interesting for me. It's certainly the thing that people want to talk to me about, which I find interesting about my book, you know, blood, sweat, and tears and all the research. And like, but let's talk about your sister. And that makes sense to me. But the thing I do think about a lot is this, which is, it shouldn't take the death of my sister to make it a better book. I would like to think that was, it shouldn't be that event that did that, but it does, and she'll never know it, but I know that she would, you know, appreciate it and probably not be surprised.
It wasn't the event. Well, I don't, if I can say, like, when
Yeah,
as a
please.
reader of the book, I was an early reader, and I thought that bringing in that, I mean, yes, it was based on an event, but it was really about grief and it was about your
Yes.
response. So what I thought was so beautiful about it is so much of the book was so theoretical and so academic and historic and very, very interesting. But then there's, you know, what becomes clear through this kind of counterpoint throughout the book is that no matter how prepared you are academically, theoretically, intellectually for death, when it comes, it floors you and it's a totally different experience than you think it's going to be. And by putting those two ideas together, I think you're saying something about the experience of death through both sides of the brain, if we want to say, or, you know, for the objective and the subjective. And I think it becomes very powerful where it would have just been an interesting academic book otherwise, you know? So,
Joanna, you're absolutely right. It's the inclusion of a kind of like personal experience about this, which is also too why I did it, which is what happens when you think you spent your whole life growing up about death and dying. And I have, like, and suddenly I have to do all this, and not for my parents, but my sister, who dies before all of us, and my parents have to watch their daughter die, you know, in front of their eyes, which was just devastating for them. You know, I was trying to figure out, you know, how do I deal with this? I mean, it gets tied up to, and then my sister had excellent hospice care in Italy. I will never say anything bad about the hospice care she received in Italy. It was top notch, except it was hospice care where they were not talking about dying, which was the weirdest thing about the hospice care, which is hospice care is very much built around the idea that you know you're going to die, and they weren't doing. So my sister ends up asking me what's going on. And I was in Italy and I told her, like, Jill, you're dying. This is what we have to talk about.
Wow,
this. And so that's what, you know, I wrote about that. And she was dead 2 weeks later. And I think so it was that experience where, like, how do I negotiate all these things, knowing what I do, like knowing everything I know about death, and still, it wasn't that I was unprepared. It's just like, I didn't know, I'd never had to respond this kind of way in that thing before. To me, it had always been about other people or other things, and this was just like all the things happening all at once to everything at the same time. And that was what became interesting to me to write about. Now, subsequent to that, I have written about it in other things. I had an article come out with the academic journal Cultural Critique, has a special issue out now on mourning without end. And I was asked by the editors to write something on mourning without end. And I said, of course, I'll write this. And I wrote it. And it's, so what happens is, so it's about my sister, but also to it, but listeners would probably want to know is, so then in 2022, my mom died in May of 2022. And then in November of 2022, my dad died. My parents died about 6 months apart, and I effectively had, all of my immediate family were dead within 4 years of each other. And as a friend of mine had said, you know, she's like, you know, that's kind of a lot to go through. And it is, she's right. And it was the same friend who was like, you know, do you think maybe you have some PTSD for all this? And I was kind of like, and I did that very male thing where, like, I'm fine. It's fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. I'm fine. There's no problem. I'm fine. And I mean, I knew I wasn't, but also too, because, like, you know, I know enough what's going on. And yeah, it was a difficult period of time. Anyway, I was asked to write about mourning without end. And so I wrote about this whole experience, thought it was going to be completely rejected by the editors, even though they asked me to do it. And it wasn't. It got published. So there we go. That's become one of the pieces I've tried to reflect on, all those deaths and what that means, and like, how do we understand it, and like, what goes on, but also too, like, how difficult it can be to just sort of, and I know this, and I have massive respect for everyone who is, you know, dealing with multiple deaths in everyday life. Cause I have, you know, I have like a great job, you know, as an academic who works in death and dying. So, you know, no one ever questions me if I say I need to deal with this death thing. They'll be like, it's your job. Of course you do. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. But also too, having a job in academia, I mean, it gives me a lot more freedom to deal with these things than people do in other jobs. So anyway, so the point is, I think now that I've become more acquainted with, more familiar with, because I'm out of necessity, everything that these personal losses that everyone goes through every day, like, I'm not unique. Like, everyone has people they know die. Like, this is just part of the human condition. So, and I always try to make the point that I'm not different than anyone in that regard.
No, you just have a platform to talk about it. And
yeah, I do.
A greater understanding, and fate gave you such a boom, 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 you know, like, yeah. I mean, not many people have that experience, honestly.
It's true. But also too, like, I also think, like, you know, we all, does how rapid something happens or not. I mean, partly, we all have, no matter when someone dies, you always think about it. There's no question about that. So which is why I'm saying, like, my dad died 3 years ago today. If you work in death and dying like I do, or any of us, and anyone who's listening to the podcast listens to death and dying, it is inevitable that we will have to think about and negotiate and navigate our own personal experiences with this. And I think that for all the reading and the sort of the projects you can do, creative, academic, otherwise, around death and dying, there's just nothing that really prepares you for going through those experiences. And yet, it is the only, to use an expression, the only way out is through, and you just keep going through it. And it, but also too, I think maybe, possibly, one of the things those of us who work in death and dying possibly have as something that can be helpful is possibly a language that allows us to talk about it.
Yeah, which is hopefully what this sort of work that we're doing in the world will help people
And
engage with. And
that's the one thing I think about, that I'm just grateful that I already had a language
yeah.
to try and talk about what was going on, or that I wasn't afraid to because I didn't think it was appropriate.
Yeah.
Or I was afraid that I would be talking about something that people didn't want to hear about, because I was like, I don't care. If I'm going to talk about this, it's because I need to talk about it. And I
Yeah.
encourage everyone to do that.
Yeah. And I have so many more questions for you, John, but we're running short on time. So I think we're going to just have to have you back a second time. But if you don't mind,
Joanne, of course, anytime.
because I know this is so important to you.
Right.
When you wrote an essay for the Morbid Anatomy Anthology, you
Right.
insisted on including this sheet where people could fill out their post-death wishes. And I found this so useful that I actually included it again with your permission in my most recent book, Memento Mori. And I would love for you to just talk a little bit about why pre-death planning is so important and what people can do at home right now, listeners, to get started with that.
Right. Well, of course, what they can do is they can buy the Morbid Anatomy Anthology book, or they can buy my book. And really, what Joanna's talking about is they're just a series of literally like worksheets where you can write down, ideas or thoughts. You can always do it in pencil, so you can erase it and change your opinion, change your mind. It's okay. Why do that? Well, it is important to it, there are a couple of reasons. One, it is important to convey your wishes about any number of death and dying topics to your next of kin, or the people who will be responsible for handling your affairs, including everything from your death to your dying to your estate, whatever that might be. It's important to make that clear to the people around you who care about you and love you, because it will make it easier. It's not necessarily an easy conversation to have, but it will make it easier for everyone involved. And that could be everything from something that might seem as innocuous to what kind of music do you want played or not played? Sometimes it's the not played part that's the important question. To what kind of service you want? What kind of advanced directives do you have as far as life support goes? What charitable giving might you be interested in after you die, in terms of money being donated to something? It's all of that, like those kinds of things. The more you can discuss it and also document it, bearing in mind you can change your mind, the better you'll be. And actually, my cautionary note from this now comes from my own lived experience with it, which is for years, I told my dad, "Dad, you have to write down all your logins and your passwords for all your online accounts." And he knew this too, because as a funeral director, he knew that there were lots of issues, particularly as everything had gone online, for families who didn't have access to any of that. So he knew what I was talking about, and got it. What he started doing was, on a piece of paper, writing everything down. Importantly, showing me where the piece of paper was, because this is the other part. If you're going to write everything down, you need to show people where it is. Or the other thing that happens is someone's like, "Oh, it's on my computer, don't worry." But their computer has got a password that no one has. I mean, this happens all the time. So, whatever it is, people have to be able to access it. This is important, because when my dad had his cardiac arrest in 2019, My mom didn't know any of this. She didn't know any of that information about how to access any, because he had taken care of paying all the bills, all that stuff. And that was just how they, you know, divvied up the house responsibilities. So it's like, Mom, don't worry. I know Dad has written this down. He showed me where it is. I know where it is in the house. It was by the computer. So I went and got it. And she's like, oh, I didn't even know you'd been doing that. I'm like, okay, fine. So I then sat down with it, transcribed everything into Excel. And even for the things I couldn't figure out, what I did have was I had the key email address password, so I could redirect things if I need. So there are a couple of things you figure out that are crucial. But I had all that information. My mom now had it too. We could do it. It was fine. It was all there. So we didn't. They didn't lose access to anything. There were no concerns about what was ever going to happen. My dad recovers from his cardiac arrest. Right. So he does recover. After being incapacitated, you know, in the ICU, the whole thing, it spends a couple more weeks in transitional care, but comes home more or less the same. But he does have some memory issues. But the thing that he said to me that I'll never forget was, I said, Dad, thank you so much for writing all your passwords down, because it really made a huge difference for me and Mom. And he goes, oh, I did that? I don't remember that. And I was like, what do you, oh God, yeah, I don't remember any of those passwords now. And I was like, wow. Oh my God. So he was alive, and my mom was, and I was able to help them, like, and we set everything up so they were able to then go for the next couple years of their lives. But then after my dad died, my mom died first, and after my dad died, having access to all of that information.
Yeah.
Completely contrary to all the terms and conditions everyone signs on online agreements, like, to which I'm like, whatever, that made all the difference in the world, because it is a complicated process. If you are in the best of times, that made all the difference in the world.
I think that's really good advice and a really easy thing anyone can do at home without accessing one of our books.
And it
you
can
know?
Be very awkward, and it can create real, I will be the first to say, it can create real trust issues for some that. Families. Like, and even then, I'll never forget one of the phone calls I completely just broke down on. It's so silly to talk about this. It's not silly, but it happened. Sad. Was, so the timing of this is probably not great. So after my father's memorial service, my dad died on November 21st, 2022, but we decided to not have the service, memorial service for him until January, in part because I know my dad would not want a memorial service that would have gotten in the way of either Thanksgiving or Christmas, because as a funeral director, he had seen lots of families see their holidays really disrupted. And I know he wouldn't want that. And there was no rush because he had a direct cremation. So did my mom, in case anyone's curious. Both had direct cremations, which, you know, is just means I literally went straight to the crematorium, and I was able, you know, to be there for both of those. There was time, is what I'm trying to say. There was time. So after the January, we have the service in January. Later that night, why I did this, I still don't know. I had to call. This is going to sound like it's a plug, but it's not. Or an advert, it's not. So I had called Delta Airlines, because they both had like Sky Miles, you know what I mean? And I was like, just doing my due diligence, finally finishing up, letting Delta know that they both were deceased, to their accounts, in case there was any fraud in their accounts or something like that. And I just completely, I don't know why, I just completely broke down. And the woman who helped me, Sharon was her name, I've never forgotten her, was so sweet and understanding, and told me what to do and how to do these things and all this stuff. And it was unbelievable. And to this day, there are still times when I've had to make the more bureaucratic, like calling the DMV was a real challenge after my dad had died. That was something about those administrative calls, of which I did a lot and you will do a lot, that became, you know, just that's, for some reason, that's when a lot of my grief seemed to come out. And I don't know why, but it was important, I think, to try and, you know, just to do all that, because it becomes more complicated if you don't even know where to start.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And so I urge listeners to take his advice very seriously. I think it's really good advice, so practical, and can make a time that's so miserable in your life a little less miserable, it sounds like.
It really does. Like, honestly, I tell my students this all the time. I'm like, if you remember anything from what I say in my class, talk to your parents in particular about end of life care wishes, advanced, like what do they want? And then also make sure you know all the passwords and or know where to find it.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that reminder too. And so to end, I have three questions that I'm asking every interviewee as a sort of anchor. The first one, I think we've pretty much gone over this, but if you want to have a pithy response to it, looking back, how has the idea of death animated your life and work?
Well, it's made my entire career possible. I mean, I've never not known death. One of my earliest memories of childhood is a woman in an open casket at the funeral home and being there with my parents. I must have been 3 or 4. Yeah. And I remember touching her hand and her hand being cold. Although as my dad would always say, it's not cold, it's room temperature. And and then just learning what death was based on that. Yeah.
If you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
If I could live forever, would I? So my immediate response is no, but also to, I kind of want to say yes, but with an option to not have to live forever. Could I come back? Well, no, because I think that the only reason you'd ever want to live forever, if that was possible, and I'm saying if that was possible, would be if you didn't age. Because if you're going to...
You won't age. So if you won't age,
then, I don't know. Part of me has the kind of like the mystery and wonder of it all, possibly. But then too, like, I don't know, at a certain point, you know, if you know everyone around you is going to die, and that's what happens, like you just, this becomes a recurring theme in so much literature and film around about, you know, the person who's immortal has to watch everyone die and get old, and you never do. And that becomes a really heavy burden at times. So there's a novelty to it, but at a certain point, I think the cautionary tale has been, it begins to wear off, which is why I think, so if you could be like, well, maybe it's time to, but I don't know. But so instinctively, probably no, it's not possible. But also too, like if it were possible, I would want to make sure that it was something I had the option to sort of like stop doing.
That's a good answer. Finally, has your work changed your thoughts about death and what perhaps might happen after?
That's a great question. For a long time, I really didn't write a lot or think a lot about grief and bereavement. And that is really what I do quite a bit now. It's not like it wasn't there. It was. And actually, my dad was a bereavement counselor in addition to being a funeral director. So I grew up around that too. But I had not spent a lot of time thinking about grief and bereavement in my own life and work. And one of the things I'm proudest of that's come out of these experiences is starting what's called the Loss and Grief Network, the staff Loss and Grief Network at the University of Bath, for all University of Bath staff who've experienced a loss of grief and bereavement, however you want to think about it, or experiencing grief and bereavement. And we meet once a month just to talk about those experiences. We've been meeting for 2 years now, going strong, and giving colleagues an opportunity to know that it's okay to talk about all this at work. And I
love that.
And it's been, for me, it's been life-changing. Literally, it's been life-changing. So
great.
I would encourage anyone to do that too.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And finally, to end, where can people who'd like to find out more about your work find out about you?
Where can people find me? Well, it's a good question. Oh, before social media got all terrible. God, like how are we supposed to promote ourselves now? you can definitely find me at MIT Press. I've got material there. One thing I would say do this, please, is the University of Bath Center for Death and Society has a monthly newsletter that is free.
And we've had newsletters. I don't think I even get your newsletter.
Well, you should sign up for it.
I will. I don't think I even knew about it until you just said so.
And we've had a newsletter for decades, way before newsletters were the cool thing to have. For everyone's all like, here's my newsletter. I'm like, we've been doing this for years. and years. All you need to do is send your email address to CDAS at bath.ac.uk and say, please sign me up for the free monthly newsletter. And that newsletter is a great way to see what's happening every month.
Fantastic. John, thank you so much for being a part of the show. And for sure, we're going to have you back because I have like half as many questions as I got to ask you.
I, of course, Joanna, applaud you. And we've known each other for many years, but I applaud everything you have done to encourage everyone to talk about death, dying, and end-of-life issues in the way that you have.
Oh, thank you, John. It's an honor. And you've always been so supportive of everything I've done. I really appreciate that. After each episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to share a few words and discuss the conversation. And so, as always, I'll turn it over to Jess first, since, again, I know John quite well, and I'm very familiar with what he has to say. And I wonder, Jess, what stood out to you? What was interesting to you?
Whew. Well, there was a lot of good stuff there. I've got 6 pages of notes. Very interesting. You know, when he very first started off, you know, mentioning funeral affordability, I think that's a really interesting point and something that, coming from his background with the family and funeral care, it was interesting that he brought up. And then the discussion that you guys had about masculinity and grief, that sounds like an interesting group that you had.
It was. And it's, I mean, yeah, it was. I mean, the book is a very important, the book that he was talking about, Ernst Becker's Denial of Death, is a Pulitzer Prize winning, probably the best known book on death and society in the United States, certainly, probably in the English speaking world is my guess. Yeah, it was definitely an interesting book group.
And going from masculinity and grief, I also thought it was interesting what he was saying from his dad's perspective about the importance of female funeral directors coming in and how he felt that really added to the industry.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah. Do you have many funeral directors as part of a community out of interest that you're aware of? Or?
A few, but not that many. Most people that I know interested in the death world now are more interested in hospice or in being a death doula than they are in being a funeral care practitioner. But there's a few.
Yeah. And that was interesting what he was saying actually about it was very generous of him to talk about his personal experiences with his sister and his parents. But the hospice care in Italy, he was very clear to point out it's excellent care, but there was a lack of conversation about dying. And that can feel surprising, can't it? You know, like, but it's great that he was there to kind of bring those things up.
And through his educational proclivities, he had a way to talk about those things, as he kept pointing out. He has that vocabulary of death, you know?
Yeah, it's the language to be able to communicate these things is so important.
Yeah.
Which is why this is great as well, this whole, you know, because it's giving the general public, people like me, a space to listen to these people that are very knowledgeable and experienced talk about it in order to articulate our own kind of thoughts. And
I hope so.
And the advice about collating passwords.
So practical and so, so important.
I'm going to like check in with my mum and my stepdad. I was like, at least have you got each other's passwords, things like that. But like, I would have no idea of my husband's. I mean, like, he could probably guess mine because I'm pretty predictable. but his, I would have no clue. And I haven't really thought about that before. So that's a really good personal reminder. And I'm sure that people listening, that will really resonate.
I hope so. You know, I think John made it really clear how in times of grief to then have to deal with that level of annoying bureaucracy must just be heartbreaking, you know, if you can save yourself that.
And it was interesting when he shared about how whilst making a lot of these administrative calls and things like that, when his parents died, that he found that actually a space which really opened up his grief, and that he, you know, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? And the last thing I wanted to say was just, I thought that story about Sharon from Delta Airlines, that was lovely. And I think that's a lesson for us all in taking the time to be kind and to give space to people that are grieving.
Yeah.
Because even the smallest interaction like that, it can make such a difference, clearly.
Yeah, he still remembers her name, right?
Yeah, I think that's beautiful.
I thought so too. Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com.
Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra, studio engineer Fernando Velasco, additional production and sound design by Katie Hill, executive producer Stephen Rajam.